This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Nicholas Kristof. He's an op-ed columnist with the New York Times. I spoke with him on September 3rd, 2010, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in a private recording studio in New York City. This interview is included in our show, Journalism and Compassion. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
Sweet. You sound good to me.
Chris, hello? Should I say hello?
You're welcome to say hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Hi, it's Krista Tippett.
Hey, Krista. Really nice to make your acquaintance this way.
Yeah, you too.
Nice to meet you in person, too, but yeah. Down the road sometime.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so glad you've agreed to taking the time to do this. And I wondered if you know that we're changing the name of the program.
I didn't know that.
Okay, so you're actually going to be one of the first programs we do with the new name.
And,
we're changing the name from Speaking of Faith to Being. So instead of Speaking of Faith with Krista Tippett, it's going to be Krista Tippett on Being, which is for a lot of reasons. I think the faith title, in public radio land, this is a young project. And we've evolved, and I think that the Speaking of Faith title is just not spacious enough for what the show has become. And then the word faith is loaded, and
right.
We keep, I kind of thought we could unload it. I thought it was actually really important when we first started this in the early 2000s that there was a show on public radio which used the word faith and kind of signaled that it can't be co-opted. But in fact, it's a stumbling block.
It's an
obstacle. Yeah. So, and the being is very big. We're still saying our tagline is still that this is a program about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas.
Okay.
And that's what we've grown into. And so the show isn't changing, but if you've heard it, then
I've heard it many, many, many times. When I do my weekend runs, I get it on. I time my runs to you, Krista.
Oh, so. I love that. And I think we probably, this will be for when we meet one day. I think we know quite a few people in common. I was a time stringer in Divided Berlin in the early 80s.
Okay.
I think, anyway, but we'll do that. We'll do that another time.
Okay.
So let's see. Well, so what I want to talk about. So when I think about the title, I think about that what we have always been pursuing, in some contrast to our public discussions about matters of faith and meaning, rather than talking drawing out competing answers or beliefs, even we've really tried to probe the animating questions behind this part of life, which is what does it mean to be human? How do we want to live? And I think that, your journalism has spoken in many ways to precisely those questions. So that's
great.
What I just want to talk about for this next period.
That's fabulous.
Who you are, what you've learned, and some of the ethical perspective you've gained on life in our time.
sure.
Okay.
I'm delighted.
All right. So let's start. First of all, I just have to say you grew up on a sheep and cherry farm, which which sounds so lovely and also a little bit is a funny juxtaposition, sheep and cherries.
Well, I mean, I think I'm probably one of the few people in the New York Times newsroom who knows how to weld
right.
or give birth to a lamb.
Oh, yeah. Although both of your parents were scholars.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I was interested to see that to learn that your father was ethnic Armenian, though I guess
right.
he grew up in Romania. Is that right? He was born in Romania.
Yeah, he grew up in an area where the flag was regularly changing, and
uh-huh.
so typically, if you asked my father what his national origins were, he'd say Romanian. His brother, growing up in the same household, would say Polish, and his
right.
sister would say Armenian.
Yeah.
And he spoke to his brother when he would call in Polish to his sister in Romanian. So they were a somewhat complex and maybe a little bit confused family.
Yeah, from that world, that vanished world. was there a spiritual or religious background to your childhood that came from them? Was there an Orthodox heritage there?
No, not Orthodox. My father, I mean, he'd grown up kind of as a Catholic Armenian, but then in practice in the U.S., practices a Roman Catholic, but a very liberal one. Mm-hmm. You know, Hans Küng was very much all over the bookshelf. and Teilhard de Chardin was one of my father's real heroes. Then my mother is a Presbyterian who is of very deep religious convictions, but also quite liberal ones.
Mm-hmm. And I also just wonder, if you look at your childhood, do you see the roots of what's really become very defining about your journalism of, an interest in compassion and empathy in human life and a kind of longing to spark that in people?
Well, I think that I always had some interest in individuals, some drive to try to make a difference. And I think that was one of the things that attracted me to journalism. But I also think it's, you know, would have been entirely possible that I would have ended up a business reporter writing about corporate earnings. And really what changed me onto the trajectory that I ended up on is that I went out and was assigned abroad, lived a good chunk of my life abroad, and just encountered poverty. And that was just, you know, life transforming, that once these issues become real and you see these things, then you can't forget the people you meet and you want to try to make a difference in some way.
Where did you first encounter poverty, really, in that way?
Maybe when I was a student at Oxford, I used to spend the vacations traveling around with a backpack. And so I remember hopping the ferry from Spain into Morocco and traveling around Morocco and, running into a little girl who was begging and taking around her her grandfather who had river blindness and was blind, and, you know, they were begging and they could communicate a little bit in French. And, all of a sudden she was very real. Her grandfather was real. And you could imagine them as, you know, people that I'd grown up with or members of my family.
Right.
And, it just seemed so horrific that this kind of thing should still be happening.
You know, something that has impressed me over the years in your journalism is that you've talked about and kind of revealed moments of learning in public, right? And there's a sense in which you've been more, I don't know if vulnerable is the right word, but open, that and which journalists aren't always, of course, when you're reporting on things, you're learning, but then you present it as information. And columnists, I think, often, wield opinions, let's say, more than you do. But you often present moments of discovery, and you're very clear that you discovered something and you didn't know this before. And I'm just also curious about, Is that an experience you had of journalism early on, or is that something that has developed for you? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, maybe because I lived for years in China, I'm very suspicious of ideologues of whatever complexion, and I think it's really important to learn empirically and to test your ideas and, occasionally be wrong. I also think that it's more, that you're more persuasive when you acknowledge that, you have changed your views and you explain how that process happened. I think it is a little bit, you do feel a little bit naked when you confess in a column that you screwed up. I think that it ultimately gives you a little bit more credibility with readers.
It's not an instinct. You know, what you've come to do, I think, pretty comfortably, it's not an instinct that's really there in classic journalistic training.
No, I mean, I think we often tend to be a little bit too defensive and, especially considering that we spend our lives running around, poking other people, that, we should be a little bit more open to introspection, to acknowledgement of our mistakes and, and, you know, have a little more of a dialectic with readers where we try to correct them sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So I spent part of this morning watching the documentary that's been made about you, Reporter. I'm assuming you've seen it.
I have.
Okay.
It's a strange experience.
I bet it is. Well, yeah, that's also another role a journalist usually isn't in, of being the focus of the
yeah,
hour.
And that was strange. I mean, I let this camera crew trail around with me in Eastern Congo, you know, because I deeply wanted this issue to get a little bit on television. Mm-hmm. But there were times out there where I would have throttled that cameraman if it wouldn't have undermined my humanitarian image. But ultimately, I was so impressed with what he did, and I think it really did help get the word out about what is happening there.
I think it does and will, and I also was really impressed with it, and as much as Congo is the focus, I think also a big interest for the people making the film and for the people watching it is again what motivates you as a journalist. So, you know, there's a line right at the beginning where he says, you're walking, I think you're walking in Rwanda there at that point, I'm not sure, maybe Congo, and you say, they're talking about you, and they say, he's here with a single objective, to make you care about what's just over the hills. And so this got me thinking, as a lot of your writing has gotten me thinking, about the role of journalism and the changing role of journalism. We talk a lot about the changing role of journalism in terms of different platforms, right?
Yeah.
But
I guess that the way I see it, when I first got the column after 9/11, after 2001, mm-hmm. then, you know, I thought, okay, I'll be this pundit, I'll fire out these opinions, I'll change people's minds over breakfast.
Yeah.
And it turned out that it really doesn't work that way, that by and large, if I write about an issue that people have already thought about, then...
Which would be like the political news of the day.
Oh, the political news of the day. Mm-hmm. Then people who start out agreeing with me think I'm brilliant, and people who start out disagreeing with me think I've utterly missed the point. And so... Over time, I came to think that, in fact, the power of a column, and maybe more broadly the power of journalism, isn't so much to change people's minds on issues that are already on the agenda, but rather it's the capacity to shine a spotlight on some issue and then thereby project it on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And on so many of the issues that I care deeply about, the reason that they're not being addressed is simply because they're not on the agenda. And shining a spotlight and making people uncomfortable about what they see in that spotlight, I think truly is the first step toward getting more resources and more attention and more energy dedicated to solving them.
And I know that Darfur is one example that people often cite with you, that you really opened the world's eyes to that, or at least U.S. eyes to that, in a way that hadn't happened before. Is that also, I mean, would that be your example that would first come to mind?
There'd be a few, and there, you know, I don't want to choose which is my favorite child.
Yeah.
But, you know, Darfur would be one. Sex trafficking would be another. Maternal mortality and fistula would be another.
And again, to me, this strikes me as a real kind of 21st century version of what an op-ed columnist in the New York Times might do. You know, that maybe it has as much to do with globalization. And also, you know, again, to this idea of motivation, I sense, I'm aware, and I know you're aware of, that in many ways we're having to re-examine the notion of objectivity, you know, what that means, what the limits of it are, how true it's been up to now. And, I mean, do you feel that also this kind of journalism that you're doing, I mean, shining a light on places and problems that people should know about and should mobilize about, that there's a shift there in a journalistic ethos as well? And I mean, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think traditionally both historians and journalists essentially wrote about what you know, in traditional terms, what the king said yesterday, or in modern terms, what the president announced. And that over time, you began to see historians over the last few decades increasingly look at what ordinary people were doing. And likewise, I think we in journalism are broadening our sense of what history is and what our first rough draft should be, and looking at these broader trends. And, you know, that was really something that my wife, Cheryl Woodun, who's also a journalist, and I, you know, that over time we began to rethink what kinds of things we should be writing on. And in particular, in China, for example, the one of the milestones of our careers was covering the Tiananmen Square demonstrations and the massacre that resulted, killing hundreds of people. You know, that I was there on Tiananmen Square. I was revolted by what I saw. For weeks, every story we wrote was on the front page.
Right.
But then the next year, we came across a study indicating that every year in China, 39,000 baby girls were dying because they didn't get the same food and healthcare as boys. Mm. And we'd never given one column inch to that issue. And that there were something like 50 million women who were missing in China, discriminated against to death, in effect. And we'd never covered that at all. And it began to make us think that maybe our journalistic priorities were too narrowly on what governments did, and that some of the biggest human rights issues actually had to do with society rather than with governments.
Hmm. I've been really intrigued also by how you have then become very interested, even in a scientific level, at how people will respond to these kinds of stories, right? you talk about, I've talked about outrage fatigue. We've talked about, you know, compassion fatigue is a phrase that's out there. So what have you learned about, because even just what you just said about the millions, thousands and millions of death, I'm very aware that those kinds of statistics are debilitating and paralyzing for people.
And you're right. My fascination with the science of this, with the social psychology and the neurology of this, really grew out of my frustration with what I was writing about Darfur. I'd go out to Darfur and I'd see these villages burned down, kids massacred, women raped, and I would write these columns, and it just felt like they were just disappearing into the pond without a ripple. Mm-hmm. And meantime, at more or less the same time in New York, I don't know if you remember, there was a red-tailed hawk named Pale Male that got pushed out of his
nest.
Didn't.
I don't remember that.
Well, it was a pair of hawks, and the male was called Pale Male, and he was living in a condo building on Central Park, and he was evicted by the building. And New Yorkers were just up in arms about this homeless red-tailed hawk. Mm. And I was sort of frustrated that I couldn't get the same reaction for hundreds of thousands of people being driven out of their homes as for one red-tailed hawk. And so that led me to look at the work in neurology and social psychology about what makes us care. And as you suggest, it's not about numbers. It's not about statistics. It's really about an emotional connection. And it's the emotional parts of the brain that light up when the brain is being imaged that lead to some kind of a moral decision. It's not the rational parts.
Right. And there's some way you put that somewhere. You said that the emotional response becomes a portal, and then rational arguments like numbers can play a supporting role.
Exactly.
It's really interesting.
That opening, that connection, that empathy is really an emotional one. It's done based on individual stories. And we all know that there is this compassion fatigue as the number of victims increases. But what the research has shown that is kind of devastating is that the number at which we begin to show fatigue is when the number of victims reaches 2.
Right. Would you tell the story about Rokia and Musa, the photographs that they used to illustrate this?
Yeah, this is from the work of a psychologist called Paul Slovic. And there were experiments where people were shown a photo of a starving girl from Mali called Rokia, a 7-year-old girl, and asked to contribute in various and there were various different scenarios, and then also a boy named Musa, and essentially people would donate a lot of money if they saw that Rokia was hungry. They wanted to help her. They wanted, likewise, when they saw a picture of Musa, they wanted to help him. But the moment you put the two of them together and ask people to help both Rokia and Musa, then at that point, donations dropped. And by the time you asked them to donate to 21 million hungry people in West Africa, you know, nobody wanted to contribute at all.
Because they're overwhelmed by that, or it doesn't spark the same reaction that actually enables people to act. Is that?
Yeah, I think it's not real. I mean, I think that, you know, mm-hmm. in evolutionary times, we could never have been exposed to these large classes of people. And so we don't really have a biological framework to feel empathy for this very large group. But we sure can feel compassion and empathy and want to help to, you know, a particular 7-year-old girl in front of us. And so my job as a journalist is to find these larger issues that I want to address, but then find some microcosm of it, some Rokia mm-hmm. who can open those portals and hopefully get people to care. And once that portal is open, then you can indeed begin to put in some of the background, some of the context, some of the larger issues, and hopefully get people to engage with that issue.
And, you know, again, in this documentary film, Reporter, where these, I think it was, I mean, the narrator is young, and I'm kind of feeling like this was a young team of documentary filmmakers. Was that right? Or am I imagining
yeah,
that?
that's reasonably true, and which means younger than me.
Younger than me. And so, you know, when he's talking, you know, where you in the Congo, he's saying, you know, that what you're looking for, you talk to a lot of people who've been suffering in a lot of ways. You see some terrible things, but he says you're looking for your Rokia for this story. And he has some misgivings about that. And I wonder if you have misgivings about that, too, even as you're talking about the scientific basis for it.
Yeah, I mean, I periodically do. It does feel sometimes a little bit manipulative. Mm-hmm. The other aspect of it is that people connect with stories that are kind of ultimately positive or triumphant. They want to be a part of something successful. And so when Cheryl and I were writing our book about women around the world, Half the Sky, right. we were very much looking for stories of individuals that would plumb the depths of terrible things that happen, but ultimately end on this kind of inspiring, happy note. And that in particular, I worried a little bit about. If we were selecting stories of women who whatever have been trafficked or gone through a fistula or whatever it may be through some kind of deplorable sexual violence, but ultimately have triumphed in some unbelievably wonderful, inspiring way, then, you know, is that a little bit too manipulative? Is that going over a line? Is that unrepresentative? And, I mean, ultimately, that's what we did because we were afraid that, people are turned off by unremitting despair, and you need to show that one can make a difference. But I do worry about that, absolutely.
Another thing that it made me wonder, not just that, but the science of this and what you've learned, that you could go and you could tell the whole horrific story with all the numbers, and that, in fact, would not mobilize newspaper readers across the world the way one thinks it should. You know, I think that when you use the word genocide now, ever after the Holocaust, as people do with Darfur, they use the word genocide. You use the word genocide, I think.
I do.
We think back to an idea we have, I believe, in the West, that if we'd only known, right, if it had only been covered, that Holocaust, that surely it wouldn't have unfolded as it did. I don't know. I think that what some of the stuff you're learning suggests that might not be true.
Darfur is, I think, a window into that issue because in past genocides, one could make the argument, not always terribly effectively, but one could at least try to make the argument that at the time the killing was going on, we didn't really fully know. We didn't mm-hmm. have a complete appreciation of just how awful it is. And if only we had known. And In fact, in the case of Darfur, we knew exactly what was going on. And it was on television, it was in the news, and, you know, it has now gone on in one degree or another longer than World War II did.
Right. Something else I wonder about is I think maybe this covering genocide is also it's about pictures and it's about stories, but there are other kinds of tragedies and atrocities. Many of the kinds of things you talk about, for example, your work with your wife, Cheryl Woodon, on women that takes many in many kinds of situations and many different issues that are named. There are kind of words and phrases that that people go around thinking themselves should be galvanizing, mobilizing, like human rights or injustice. And yet again, so even in the work I do, I'm very aware that those words don't take us very far. And in fact, some of these words that we think are noble, peace is another example, are in fact very controversial, very politically laden. They've got ideological connotations for some people. And I wonder if you think about that, about vocabulary and about having to shake up, even not rely on phrases that one thinks should be effective.
Yeah. I'm very engaged in when I'm writing about Congo or Darfur or any of these issues in really trying to grab the reader. And, you know, I know that your average reader, if they come across my column on the subway to work and they see that it's about Darfur, for example, that, you know, okay, they've got to be at work in 30 minutes. They know terrible things are happening in Darfur, but it's not really going to be relevant to them that day, and they're likely to turn the page. And so I try to use whatever mix of headline, engaging first sentence, occasionally, in the case of a headline, maybe a little bit of bait and switch,
right.
to try to,
right.
To suck people in.
Mm-hmm. And not assume that there's any code or shorthand that is going to be universally interesting or appealing.
No, and I think that, in fact, we tend to, in journalism especially, and probably especially in opinions, we tend to speak to our own communities.
Yeah.
And we tend to recite the arguments that are most persuasive to those who already want to do whatever you do, but are often least persuasive to those who come at this, you know, who are skeptical.
So I'd like, what's going on? Do I sound okay? Sounded funny for a minute. Okay. I'd like to talk about some of the things that you've written about that you've learned in all your travels, in all the stories you've covered that I think are counterintuitive.
Okay.
Or that might sound counterintuitive. So for example, I started thinking, I wrote down this realpolitik of compassion, which is because, you know, you are out there representing, embodying compassion for many people, trying to spark it with your work, but you're very pragmatic, and you've learned a lot that I think might be surprising to people. For example, you talk, and I think this was in the film also, you're talking to the students who've come with you, and you talk about how just because there has been an outrageous injustice, it doesn't mean that the victims of that are any more reliable for you as people to talk to about what happened as the soldiers who may have committed the injustice. You said there's a tendency to believe victims, and that's
yeah.
not necessarily right.
Yeah, I've learned this the hard way.
Okay.
That when you go out and you come across some brutal injustice, soldiers who've massacred people, then the immediate tendency is not only to feel sympathy for those who've been butchered, but also to believe their stories. And, you know, in fact, it turns out that victims lie, just as perpetrators lie. And they are so outraged by what has been done to them that they often exaggerate And you have to be just as meticulous and insistent upon verification when you're talking to those victims as you would be skeptical when talking to the perpetrators.
Can you give me an example of experience you had? Yeah.
I think I first encountered that when I was covering Tiananmen in China, and I was on Tiananmen Square, and so I saw what I saw, and I knew, for example, that there had not been a massacre right in the middle of the square. I'd seen people shot on the north end of the square in individual groups and so on, but there had been a group of students in the middle, and there were a lot of reports that, supposed eyewitness accounts about how tanks had run them over and or machine gunned this group of students, and I knew that that had not happened. And in fact, in the New York Times, we ended up mistakenly publishing a supposed eyewitness account that the moment I read it, I knew it had been fabricated. And that, that taught me this sort of skepticism about victims that I've just seen again and again, whether it's in Darfur or Congo or victims of human trafficking, whatever it may be.
Something that really struck me in the documentary, and this is also things you wrote about, you met a warlord, a Congolese warlord. There's so much paradox there. I mean, for starters, right, this line between who's a victim and who's a perpetrator is so thin, right? Because, he started out as a victim.
Yeah, and perpetrators usually claim that they are victims, uh-huh. and that is why they have to massacre the other side.
Yeah. Then there was the religious fervor, that Christian fervor, which seemed. I mean, even so, in this case, because it was filmed, I got to watch it too.
Well, I couldn't believe it when this warlord who. Was well known for being involved in mass killings and mass rapes and just brutal predations of people there. He came out with a button on his chest that said "Rebels for Christ."
Right.
And where did that come from? And he, announced that he was a Christian pastor, that he had a little chapel. Right in this building we were in, and in fact, before we he then served us dinner and said grace, and it you just wondered where this all came from. And I think that I don't know, maybe some element of it was sincere. I think also that he perceived that this was when President Bush was in the White House, and that he perceived that perhaps there would be a little bit more support for a warlord who seemed to be a Christian warlord.
I had to tell you that I was watching this, and my 12-year-old son walked in, and he hadn't seen anything else, but he said, those guys don't seem so bad. And you know what he was seeing too. I mean, there was a real charisma about that. Not the warlord, maybe not so much, but the people around him.
Yeah, frankly, that is often true. That if you go and I often do try to go out and sort of seek out the perpetrators, because I want to understand what it is that drives some people to go and butcher children, what makes those people tick.
But what have you learned about that?
I've learned that people have an amazing capacity for self-delusion, to feel themselves threatened, and that this is the only way to address the risks to those they care about, and that in general, even the most savage butchers will treat their own little community, their own clan, their own friends, and fortunately for me, their invited guests, with considerable courtesy and warmth and friendship.
Hmm. I mean, how does that, if I just, this idea of what it means to be human, I mean, how does that change your thinking about humanity and the world your children are growing up in?
I think that when Cheryl and I lived in Japan, I was fascinated with the older generation of Japanese who had committed unbelievable atrocities in China, the Philippines, so many places, and yet were the most courteous, civil people who I could have imagined. And I interviewed an awful lot of them. And I think one of the things that struck me was just how fine a line it is, and that when you feel threatened when there are especially kind of a group of you, this mob instinct can take over, and we are capable of doing things that, ultimately later we can't believe we did, that we're ashamed about. And I think this is something that, it's a human tendency that we really need to push back against very deeply when we do feel these kinds of fears.
I think something that's related to that you also have emphasized is the importance of security and maybe even taking precedence over whether we're talking about democracy, right? Or you're saying that it is a prerequisite for helping alleviate poverty. And I'm not sure that's a message people want to hear. It's something that's come through so much in my conversations about a lot of subjects over the years also, that one of the things is in this culture in the U.S. that we take for granted and don't realize we take for granted, don't realize how much it makes possible, is the rule of law. This seemingly simple fact of life.
There is always the tendency to think that the most humanitarian thing you can do is to go build a school, build a hospital. And I remember in Central African Republic coming across a clinic that, the only thing left of it was a little sign out front saying built by the German aid agency. Mm-hmm. Because people were willing to build clinics, but they weren't willing to help provide security. So some warlord had come through and burned it, and who knows what had happened to the doctors and the nurses and the patients. And I saw the same thing in Chad, for example, that once you lose security, then farmers can't go into their fields, so they starve. People sometimes sell their daughters. You can't begin to address other humanitarian needs until you begin to address security. And I think that especially in the aftermath of Iraq and the mess in Afghanistan, is something that is really hard for us to figure out how to do, and even hard for us to talk about as a humanitarian issue.
But where do you come out on who is responsible for creating structures of security? Or, can that be imposed by external forces? Are you, when you write about places like this, Congo is a great example again, a huge part of the problem is it's divided into these competing warlords, right? It's not just that cities aren't safe, roads aren't safe.
I don't think there's any one solution that is going to fit different places. In Afghanistan, I think our effort to impose security by sending 100,000 troops is essentially failing, and is a $100 billion a year failure. It's an unbelievably expensive failure. On the other hand, there have been places like Liberia or Sierra Leone where a really, really modest contingent of forces or even a ship offshore can just tip the balance toward a little bit more security, and that ultimately then builds upon itself and creates order. I think so much depends on what local people want and, whether they ultimately welcome us or UN peacekeepers or whatever it may be welcome those outsiders, or whether they are suspicious of them as people who want to steal their oil, infidels who want to impose some kind of foreign belief system. So I think there's no cookie-cutter solution there, but there are some places where I think we can do a better job of helping create that kind of order and going after these warlords who, in the Lord's Resistance Army where Central African Republic and Sudan and Uganda come together is this, one of the most brutal organizations in the world. And for two decades, it has been destroying this vast area because people can't farm. They can't live in the villages because the rebels come through and kill people and kidnap them.
And you think that needs outside intervention?
Yeah, I think a good case where outsiders, with helicopters, with planes, with satellites, can figure out where those rebels are, can help local forces and local villagers, and where that assistance would really be hugely welcomed, and can go in and destroy them. And once that is done, then you can begin to build schools, clinics, and all these other kind of humanitarian steps.
So you have been criticized, or there have been some critical exchanges on your coverage, for example, of Africa. There were some charges that you tend to portray the victim African and the white savior. But I think that's a charge that's leveled, broadly, that's something that people have to be, that's an image that's out there, and it may be a problem. I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think frankly that's a somewhat fair charge. Mm-hmm. I do periodically write about African heroes and so on, but it is true that probably disproportionately when I go out, I will find somebody who has a American connection. Mm-hmm. The reason, again, is that is what it's hard enough to get readers to read about and care about some kind of distant crisis. And if you don't have any connection, anybody they can relate to, then you've lost. But if you can have somebody in there who builds that connection, then you're more likely to get people to read and ultimately to make a difference.
To get involved. I'm just curious how you respond to some African voices, say, for example, the economist Dembisa Moyo and others who are really saying that Africans have experienced themselves to be defined by their needs, and that white people and Westerners coming in to solve their problems for them has inhibited them from creating their own infrastructure, their own rule of law, their own solutions to poverty. I'm curious how you react to those ideas that are out there now and to that discussion that's taking place.
Again, I think that there is some truth to that. I think that it's worth that one of the things that crowd gets absolutely right is that helping people is a lot harder than it looks, and that the the kind of foreign aid contingent has sometimes been too glib about how easy it is to solve problems, to make a difference. And one of the things I've learned over and over is that everything goes wrong, things are unplanned. You just
You also write about how some of the things that we look at as problems, like a sweatshop, I mean, you've written a lot about this, is not necessarily the problem that we imagine that it's.
That's true. I'm one of the few Americans who is truly sympathetic to sweatshops, really because of the time I spent in Asia and seeing the way they became an avenue for people to kind of ride the escalator up, and mm-hmm. that they provided a lot of employment for people, tended to be wretched jobs, but usually not as wretched as working in a rice paddy or in construction jobs or selling cigarettes in the street or just a million other jobs that tend to be available. And my fear has been that the hostility to sweatshops has meant that manufacturers don't go to Africa. I mean, Africa's problem mm-hmm. isn't that it has sweatshops, it's that it doesn't have any sweatshops. Mm. And typically the only thing worse than a sweatshop is indeed no sweatshop at all, no employment whatsoever. I guess the other thing that I really do worry about, and if I were critiquing my own kind of approach, yeah. then just between you and me, okay?
All right. I won't tell anyone.
It would be not so much the white heroes bit, but it would really be this question that often I focus on things that go wrong. That when I write about Africa, for example, so much of it is about the Congo or Sudan or about AIDS in southern Africa or about malaria or pneumonia, whatever it may be. Right. And that conjures an image in the reader of a continent that is completely screwed up, that doesn't have anything working out for it. And the upshot of that is to dampen tourism, dampen business investment, and just leave people discouraged about the possibilities of the continent in a way that is really misleading. I mean, there are a lot of parts of Africa that have been incredibly successful. And so that is something that that troubles me, and that I try to adjust my coverage to convey that more complicated reality. But that is something that I worry about in my kind of reporting.
Do you think that your early experiences in Asia and your enduring interest in Asia gives you a certain kind of perspective on the possibilities in Africa's future?
Yes, I'm always struck that development experts who spent their careers in Africa tend to be pretty pessimistic, and they, you know, that development is just difficult and tough, and you strive, and you know, maybe you'll make a little bit of difference somewhere. Meanwhile, development experts who spent their time in Asia, they sort of assume, you toss out a few seeds, and you know, next day you'll have a big field. I, in my time abroad, I saw the sprouting of China, South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, all these countries. And they had different economic models. It wasn't, you know, one precise model, mm-hmm. but it led you to believe that places are not hopeless, and that we really can see just complete transformations that end up more or less eliminating the worst kinds of poverty.
And even knowing all the places you've been in Africa, even, you know, the focus you've had on places like Congo and Sudan, I mean, can you even imagine that kind of hope and that kind of transformation there?
Oh, I absolutely can. And I think, in some places in Africa, we're really beginning to see it. Mozambique used to be just one of the most depressing, impoverished places on Earth. And since the war there ended, it became one of the more rapidly growing and a lovely country. Mm. Rwanda, since the genocide, has prospered and is just a, you know, wonderfully tidy and efficient country, somewhat repressive, but just booming. In West Africa, Ghana is something of the same. So I think increasingly we are seeing examples that, challenge the stereotype of Africa's failure and really point to the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. I also think, it's just worth underlining that the different countries and cultures you saw grow and be transformed in Asia were dealing with big problems and difficult histories as well, right? I mean, I think Americans have this idea also of us as just having been immediately successful and not having any issues. And in fact, that this democratic project took decades and centuries to become what we think of it as now.
That's right. And I mean, it was really kind of looking at Asia success and trying to figure out what the lessons of it were mm-hmm. that got me interested in this question of the role of women, because while the economic model was different in each Asian country, one of the common themes was that they educated girls in a way that traditionally had not been true and then brought them into the formal labor force. And as a result, they ended up hugely expanding the labor force, tremendously expanding productivity, and creating this kind of a virtuous cycle of economic growth, which I think is also kind of similar. I think one of the explanations for Americans' prosperity over the last couple of centuries is that women were a, you know, they were not marginalized. They were a part of the economy, a part of society, and that a country just cannot grow if it's got one hand tied behind its back.
So I do want to talk to you about religion, because you've written so interestingly about religion as well. And that's actually a good starting point, because you're really clear that, that the way I remember this column you wrote about the elders at approaching these issues of women, which is a consortium of people like Desmond Tutu, Mary Robinson. Who am I forgetting in that group? Is Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter. Right? And that there was a quote in there from Mary Robinson who said, if there is one overarching issue for women, it's the way religion can be manipulated to subjugate women. And I think that there are lots of stories and images of that out there now. It's clearly a reality. And you, though, and even as you point at that, you've taken, it seems to me almost to your own surprise, you've come to a very complex understanding. You have also pointed out in other places that Pentecostal and evangelical churches have done a lot, have been emancipatory forces for women in some parts of the world, especially in Africa.
Yeah, I think it's a hugely complicated reality. And, you mentioned Pentecostals. I mean, I've got, nothing in common with Pentecostals theologically or in terms of social policy. But when you go around rural Africa, it strikes you that, A, not only are Pentecostal churches absolutely everywhere, but that they really have become, in many ways, a force for the emancipation of women in a couple of reasons, unexpected ways. One is that because they discourage people spending money on alcohol, which tends to be a major way that that disposable incomes get spent, that, you know, in those families that join a Pentecostal church, there tends to be a little less money going to alcohol and a little more money going for their children's education. And that women also in Pentecostal churches tend to have much more of a role than in the more mainline churches, and that often for these women who are uneducated, who have never really played any role in society, it's their first chance to speak and to be listened to.
Right.
And it builds some kind of a sense of self-confidence that, you know, is part of this process of change. And you know, more broadly, I look around Africa and, you know, I'm aghast at what conservative churches and the Catholic Church have done in terms of opposing condoms, for example, to as a mechanism to prevent the spread of AIDS. I mean, you know, it is deplorable. There are, I think, an awful lot of people who died because of that opposition to condoms. On the other hand, you know, I also go out and I see Catholic-run orphanages looking after AIDS orphans, Catholic hospitals that are often the only game in town at providing health care. And I think that and also that, frankly, that often evangelicals and conservative Christians are more likely to donate money or more generous not only with their time but also with their money than more secular people are. And so I think that, we're often I think there's something. I think there's plenty to condemn about the kind of moralizing and the hostility to condoms, in particular, the hostility to reproductive health that results in more abortions in places like Africa. But I also think there's a lot to admire in terms of the tremendous good work that the Catholic Church and that an awful lot of Christian organizations are doing in the grassroots all over Africa.
You know, I heard you. I think this is one in one of your YouTube appearances on the New York Times blog that you were talking about Islam, and you said that Islam is like the proverbial elephant that the blind man touched, and I'd forgotten what that proverb was, but then I understood it as you kept going. But that whatever you know that what you encounter that you can encounter very very different aspects of Islam, and also of Christianity as you're describing.
That's right. And we, you know, we tend to know the elephant of Christianity and tend to know that, okay, you can, you know, touch a trunk that is a, you know, some kind of a very liberal church in Boston and
right.
A leg that is a Southern Baptist church uh-huh. somewhere else. And you know, we know that it's an enormously variegated institution. That is pushing in all kinds of different ways. I think we don't appreciate the degree to which that is also true of Islam. And right now, our views of Islam are so much shaped by its most venal elements, by Al-Qaeda, for example, or by Afghanistan. And, you know, those are true. Those are real components mm-hmm. of Islam. But I think it's also important to realize that, you know, by the most populous Muslim country in the world, by far, is Indonesia, which has, after all, elected a woman president. You know,
right.
We haven't.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And so I just think it's a much more complicated reality. I've just been, as it happens, I've been reading lately some of the 19th century anti-Catholic materials published in this country, in the United States.
Fascinating, yeah.
It's fascinating. I think that there's some parallel between the horror of Catholicism that many well-meaning Americans had in the 1850s to the horror of Islam that many well-meaning Americans have today.
Yes, yes. There were Catholic churches burned and...
That's right.
Right? We forget the reason we have a Catholic school system is because Catholics couldn't be teachers in public schools.
That's right. And it was, I think in a similar way, it was, in general, the people who were, what happened was, you know, you had a small number of real hate mongers, but a much larger group of people who were kind of worriers, and they didn't really believe everything that was said about the Catholic Church, but they were ambivalent, and they saw these Irish coming to America or these others who they regarded as outsiders as having a different tradition.
Right.
They worried about whether Catholics would be loyal to America or to the Pope. And as a result of this kind of ambivalence, that created a climate in which a convent in Boston, for example, as you say, could be burned to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you, because of how much you travel and what you do, you've been able to gain just a very big view of the world. And also, I think, at the different paces and the different places at which all of our different, these continents and the countries and cultures within them are existing right now, coexisting.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the Muslim world, of course. And Pakistan is one of my, you know, favorite countries, and I've come across you know more than my share of really thuggish, demagogic imams and mullahs who, you know, try to keep girls from going to school, who believe that a girl should be killed if she, you know, has an eye on some boy or some boy has an interest in her. I mean, just really people who just you know, infuriate me. But I remember, you know, but a certain amount of this is also embedded coming from culture rather than religion, and it's very hard to disentangle them. And I remember in Pakistan once, interviewing a woman who had secretly married the man she loves, and now her family was trying to kill her. And in fact, her father and two brothers had kidnapped her. They locked her up in the hut, and they were just debating whether to murder her, which is what one brother wanted, or whether to sell her to the brothels in Karachi, which is what another brother wanted to do. And she, while they were deciding for a few days, she baked some chapati for them with sleeping powder inside and then escaped. But she was not a Muslim. She was a Christian. And she was a member of that Christian minority. And it was just a reminder to me that these views that are just so horrific and antagonistic that we sort of assume are emerging from the Quran, that Muslims may regard those sort of more fanatical Muslims may regard them as Islamic, but that Christians in those places practice them as well, and that it's just a lot more complicated than it may seem at first.
Right. You this was it. One other thing about religion. You wrote. I think this was in 2008. I wonder, I'd like to ask you how this was received. You really wrote, and this is one of these places where you've actually written a bit over the last few years and during the early 2000s and during the period of the Bush presidency, as your understanding of who evangelicals are and the diversity of that movement and that tradition. You wrote about evangelicals as the new internationalists. And he wrote this, liberals believe deeply in tolerance and over the last century have led the battles against prejudices of all kinds, but we have a blind spot about Christian evangelicals. They constitute one of the few minorities that on the American coasts or university campuses, it remains fashionable to mock. What was the response you got to that column?
It was absolute outrage from from the coasts.
Yes, and the university campuses.
And the university campuses. People who were, incredibly indignant and saying that these are people who are spreading bigotry and hatred, and the proper thing to do is precisely to stand up to that kind of hatred and bigotry. From the evangelical community, there was sort of a stunned but somewhat welcome. People were pleased but sort of surprised. I'm not sure if it was that column or a different column. But writing about evangelicals' work in Africa, the headline was Hug an Evangelical.
Yes.
And a little bit later, one of the evangelical organizations, that I never agree, maybe it was Focus on the Family, of course, which I disagree with 100%, but they had a headline saying, Hug a Liberal.
Oh, that's good.
Yes, it was the beginning of our...
You created empathy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, in some place you suggest that bleeding heart liberals need to reach out to bleeding heart conservatives. And I was going to ask you if bleeding heart conservatives reach out to you. That sounds like maybe an example of that.
No, they actually have. And I mean, that really is something I believe in deeply, that... if you look at sex trafficking, for example, this is one of the true outrages on the scene today, that there are probably more girls who are trafficked against their will today than people who were enslaved at the height of the slave trade. And they are, more disposable because they're worth less money. Their sales price is lower today than it was in 1860 after adjusting for inflation. So there is this huge issue here, and liberal feminists, secular feminists are doing great work on it. Right-wing Christian evangelicals are doing great work on it. But because there is this incredible gulf of mistrust between them, they tend not to cooperate. And there tends you don't even tend to have a similar vocabulary with which to address the issue. Mm. The right tends to talk about prostitutes. The left tends to talk about sex workers.
Oh, that's interesting.
And each side is just very suspicious of the other. But we're not going to make progress on this. And, you know, we're not going to get those pimps in jail where they belong unless left and right and secular and religious are more willing to work, to hold their nose and work together.
Do you have any sense of movement forward on that?
There, you know, periodically there are some signs of progress on that issue. One of the things we'd recommended in our book was a major effort, a bipartisan effort to eradicate obstetric fistula around the world.
Right.
And it looks as if there will be a bipartisan bill introduced in Congress, you know, with, again, sort of support from the feminist left and the evangelical right to do just that. So there are a few examples, but, you know, the default position is to be deeply distrustful.
Hmm. I saw someplace someone asked you who your favorite philosopher was, and you said it was Isaiah Berlin. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Could you describe your answer to that?
Sure. I was studying law at Oxford, and of course, law is one of the more boring things you can possibly study, which is why I ended up as a journalist rather than a lawyer. But it's also why I began sort of, you know, reading more philosophy on the side, and I encountered Berlin's work and met him. And I think what appeals to me most about Isaiah Berlin's writings is that so much of philosophy and so much of the Western world has been a search for the one true answer, and whether it's utilitarianism, whether it's some kind of a Kantian categorical imperative, or whatever it is that we try to maximize.
Whether it's the ideology of left-wing feminism or right-wing Christianity.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But yeah. there is this search for the one true answer.
Mm-hmm.
And Isaiah Berlin emphasized that it's more complicated than that, and that there is maybe this deeply embedded yearning for one answer, but that in fact there are many different things that we value, and they are incommensurate. That you can't you want to maximize happiness, but the happiness yardstick doesn't really you can't make it link up with the dignity yardstick or the human rights yardstick or whatever it may be, and that these trade-offs are just a part of the human condition, and that we have to struggle and search for answers and at times acknowledge that this is a tentative answer, we're not sure that we're right, and yet even acknowledging that, still act on that. And you know, one of the problems I think for liberals is that they become paralyzed by complexity and paralyzed by the possibility that they're wrong. And Berlin, at least to me, emphasizes that one has to be conscious of the ability that we may be wrong, that we don't necessarily have the answer, and yet be willing to act on that and you know, act as if that is the right thing to do and the moral thing to do, and advance that cause, whatever it may be. So so Berlin, in this very messy 21st century world, Berlin kind of conveys a reality that speaks to me and that helps me resolve my own challenges in life.
Hmm. You know, I've noticed that a lot of times when people interview you, they remark that you're less depressed and depressing than they expected you to be. Have you noticed that?
I people must think that I just sort of sit around, that I'm like Eeyore. But in fact, you go out and, you know, you write about these terrible things happening around the world, but I come back not fundamentally depressed by them, as just inspired by our capacity to make a difference, to respond, to do the right thing. On that same trip to the Congo that was in the movie. We saw the warlord, and you know, I was infuriated by him. But the person who I think spoke to me the most on that trip was a Polish nun in the town of Rutsuru, who I met, who was there in this little town that had been pretty much abandoned by A groups, that was surrounded by warlords, where there were killings every day. And she was single-handedly feeding orphans, educating kids, staving off the warlords. And I was just so inspired by that kind of commitment to humanity, to trying to make a difference, that it ultimately fundamentally left me reassured rather than depressed about humanity.
It seems to me you've had a pretty big year personally, too. And again, you've done that in public, right? Like you do your journalism in public. I mean, that your father died.
That's a very
moving column you wrote about him.
Thank you. He was an extraordinary person.
Clearly. I know the death of a father is affects people in ways they don't expect. And I wonder if this experience, you know, does this shed any new kind of light or feeling on your sense of what you have done with your life? And
I think that any kind of encounter with mortality like that makes you conscious about what your own legacy will be, what you want that legacy to be. And so, you know, I think that probably, you know, that encounter kind of reminds me that I do want my journalism to make a difference. And I do feel as if I have, with my New York Times real estate and with my books, a just truly incredible spotlight, and that I can wield that in ways that, you know, maybe at the margins can make this a little bit of a better world.
I think about, I actually think a lot about this Jewish moral longing and commandment, tikkun olam, repair the world. And about how for most people, I think what that means is, you know, repairing the part of the world that you can see and touch. And for most of us, that's pretty close by. And yet you do, as you say, have this big, huge platform and this this large palette.
I think that there's really a yearning on the part of so many people to make a difference, but also a sense, you know, people are locked in their own rhythms of the day. They're busy. They worry about corruption, about whether help really will make a difference. And one of the things that has been so wonderful that Cheryl and I have encountered with our book is that, you know, we'll give a lecture somewhere, often at a college campus, and then afterward, typically it'll be some young woman, a recent graduate, who will come up and who'll say, yeah, I just want you to know I read your book and I'm leaving next week for the Philippines or Guatemala, wherever it may be, and that they in turn are now, you know, not just reading and not just aware of things, but are now actually going and doing things. And it strikes me that in almost every case where we follow up, that they go off and they think that they're going to go and empower Guatemalan villagers, for example, or, you know, Filipino slum dwellers. And they probably do that. But we have a somewhat mixed record in helping others. But those efforts have an almost perfect record in helping ourselves. And whether or not they empower those Guatemalan villagers, they always end up empowered themselves.
I can't help but be really curious about the balancing act that you play. I mean, you have three children, you have a marriage, and you travel a great deal. And you're clearly a person of compassion in general. I don't think you're one of these people who's compassionate towards the rest of the world and not at home. I really don't sense that. So talk to me about how do you manage this? And
well, our kids are, you know, among the very few who take their vacations in, you know, wherever in AIDS villages in China. Or I mean, the last family vacations we've had, the most recent one was the West Bank Before that, it was Zimbabwe and Zambia. The next one will probably be Haiti. And I remember my 12-year-old daughter, I was dragging her through Honduran slums at one point, and she said, Dad, you know, all my friends, they go to vacation in France and Italy. Can we ever just go to a beach? And so, you know, that is one way that we try to reconcile these things, that Cheryl and I do want to show our kids some of the rest of the world. It has been a source of unbelievable experiences for us to go with our kids to these kinds of places. But, you know, at the end of the day, there are real trade-offs there. And again, there are times when I will miss my kids' soccer games because I am out in Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, one of the more terrible balances you have to do is the risks that I believe deeply in covering some kinds of stories that can be perilous. And yet I believe deeply in, you know, always being there for my kids. And so you, you know, you try to cover stories that you care deeply about where it is going to make a difference, but while always ensuring for the sake of your family as well as yourself that you do so in as safe a way as you can.
And you did have a kind of brush with mortality, a cancer scare very close to home this year too.
That's right. I had a tumor in my kidney, so that was carved out, and the expectation had been that it was a 90% chance that it would be kidney cancer, which is actually usually lethal. I was in the lucky 10% that it was not a cancer. It was a tumor that is not cancerous, and so I'm fortunately just fine. There's, you know, I was backpacking this summer. I'm all cured, and there is no kind of greater risk down the road. So.
Okay.
Touch wood, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to ask you two more questions. I wonder how you respond to, I think, and I, this is, you know, I have a bit of a media platform too, and, but I also, I'm just so aware of, I feel trade-offs I make or, you know, feeling like I have a very limited feeling torn, this is awfully hard, feeling torn between, you know, my obligation just to give my children the best life I can right now for these years that I'm raising them, right? And which I feel so limits my capacity to be, gosh, even as compassionate as I want to be, as much less engaged as I want to be in great problems of the world that also concern me. I mean, you have this profession that allows you, I think, with trade-offs of your own, as you said, to address both. But what do you say to people who just struggle with the practicality of?
Well, I mean, there are certainly trade-offs there. But in general, I think as parents, we not only want to read bedtime stories to our kids, but we also want to model compassion, empathy, and engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And those are kinds of things that kids aren't going to absorb because we tell them they're important. They're going to absorb because they see those are the things that we care about. And so I do think that while that doesn't erase the trade-offs, that there are ways in which we can be engaged and to some degree, you know, involve our kids and get them engaged. And, you know, in ways that actually create new bonds of experience and expose them in a way that a school never will.
Right. And take those on as actually an essential part of raising them, right? Giving them a good life.
Yes, and empower them. We, mm-hmm. As a family, we built a school in Cambodia, for example. And so we took the kids there for the opening. And so they, you know, they saw Cambodian kids who were the same age as them, and who otherwise would not have had a chance to go to school. And for whom, you know, the amount of money that they might spend on a coat, you know, would be able to buy pens and pencils in a way that would be ultimately transformative for them. And so I think that at least, I can't pretend that the kids then never wanted to buy a soft drink after that and wanted to fuddle the money off to buy pens and pencils. But, you know, obviously it doesn't work that way. But I do think that those kinds of exposures and that kind of modeling behavior really is useful in helping to shape, you know, the kind of kids with the values that we emulate and would like to see in them.
Mm-hmm. So just going back to an early story you told about covering Tiananmen Square, which was a huge world event, which was on the front page of the papers for days, which won you the Pulitzer Prize, I think. And then, as you said, in the year that followed, you and your wife, Cheryl Woudun, who's also a journalist, became aware of this, in fact, much larger tragedy that was unfolding all the time of violence to girls. I just wonder, as you look at, I wondered if we could just look at, you know, there are big issues right now. We could all easily draw a list of what's going to be on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow. You know, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, some kind of seeming clash between Islam and the West, climate change. But I wonder, as you look around right now, you know, what are things you know about that are under the radar that are just as important that you're watching?
Well, the evolution of finding out what was happening in rural China towards women was eventually writing this book, in which we do argue that just as the central moral challenge in the 19th century was slavery and in the 20th was totalitarianism, in this century the paramount moral challenge for the world will be the abuse that is directed toward so many women and girls around the world. And so I truly think that that is going to be one of the great subtexts of this century, you know, to get girls into school, to offer them opportunities, to stop bride burnings, sex trafficking, genital cutting, you know, this whole panoply of practices. So I think that is one of the great, you know, undercurrents in the question of whether countries can make better use of the female halves of their population is going to be one of the things that's going to determine how successful they are and how stable and peaceful they can be. So I think that would be one that I would emphasize. And another would be the question that for all of human history and indeed for all of humanity, people have, by and large, or many of them have lived in poverty. And in this century, we have the capacity to really end that extreme poverty. And the question is whether we can really muster the political will and capacity to take those steps so that it will indeed be eradicated.
And I think the analogy you draw is very interesting because there was political will and political movement eventually around slavery, for example. I mean, from where you sit, can you imagine that kind of energy, that kind of action around these issues of women and of poverty?
Yeah, I really can. I think it's very hard to predict what issues will engage people, but I think that just as in the 1780s, once people became aware of what life was like on a slave ship, then they were revolted by it and couldn't stand it. I think in the same way that, you know, once people realize what goes on in forced prostitution, that they, you know, will react to it and will want to have those brothels closed down. And once they also see the opportunity that is created by educating girls and just how cheap it is and how much that can bolster an economy, that will be an opportunity they will not want to pass up. So I think that things are coming together and that just kind of change is taking place already. And, you know, the question is just whether we're going to end up watching it or being a part of it.
Hmm. Okay. Well, this has been great. It's been great.
It's been Really my pleasure.
We will, I think we know when this is going to be on the air, but we'll let you know for sure. It's in September, and we'll send you a CD if you use those old-fashioned things anymore.
Terrific.
Yeah, and I do hope we'll meet one day. Are you going to be at the Clinton Global Initiative at all?
I will be.
Oh, I'll be there too. So let's try to find each other. I'd like to meet you in person.
No, I'd love that.
Okay.
I won't be there. I'm not sure which day it begins. I'm out of town Monday, coming back Tuesday morning, and then I'll be kind of in and out the rest of the time.
But I'll be there. I'll be there all those days. I'm moderating the technology plenary thing, which is Thursday morning, but I'll be around the other day, so I'll try to find you as well.
I'll look forward to that.
Great.
And
okay.
In introducing me, if you can mention Half the Sky, that'd be great.
Oh, I absolutely will. I'll mention Half the Sky, and we may read from it a little bit too.
Great.
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Krista.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you, Paul. Take care, Ben. Have a great weekend.